Another session of the class. Welcome, everybody. Well, 2 weeks from today, all the people that are working on projects will do their final presentation, so I hope everybody is moving forward. And if you have any questions, you know, please talk to me. And I think I'd still like to get updates on your progress so I know how well you're doing. As I mentioned, we'll have the presentations out in that area over there, and there's tabletops, there's outlets, there's bulletin boards and stuff, so you should have a lot of area to work with. And we'll all go around and listen to your presentations, and everybody will have an opportunity to grade each other. You don't grade your own team, you grade other people's teams, so... that's the day for everybody to be here. I should mention that Jenny Caratley's slides from last Thursday are online now. So if you want to review those, that's where they are. Anybody have any questions right now? Pass around the sign-up sheet. I have a really good question for discussion today, and this can be sort of controversial, so I'll try to take a neutral position on it and just try to lead the discussion. There's been a lot of discussion over the years about Jerry Lewis's muscular dystrophy telethon, which is over Labor Day, and he's been doing it for years and years. And there's many people with disabilities who think that he's really doing a disservice to the community and to the folks that he's trying to help. And so I explored this a little bit yesterday and today, and to try to really get a feel for, you know, what the problem might be. And I came across this picture today, and if anybody is as old as myself and Professor Nelson, we know that this is from the late 50s, and this was the March of Dimes, and that was an effort to get money to fight polio that affected kids. But in looking at this picture and looking at the way some of these... organizations ran, it's sort of interesting and subtle. I mean, just look at this picture. You know, first of all, who is this person here? Who do you think that person is?
Keeper.
Okay. It's not a parent. It's somebody other than a parent. So if the parents aren't there, then where are these children's family? And are these children orphans then? Are these children somebody that really need, you know, daily care, that can't get along without your donations? I mean, it's really sort of subtle. And, of course, these children are nicely dressed, but, you know, still, you know, being in braces and stuff is not very attractive. So it really puts these kids in a position of vulnerability, you know, exposing their neediness and trying to use that as a way to facilitate, you know, your donations. Does anybody have any comments on this? Jenna?
I feel like it's kind of a fine line just because, like, in one sense it is almost kind of exploiting it and taking it to, like, a degree where it's almost, you're not sure how the image is supposed to be taken, but at the same time, if you look at it as an organization, it does seem like it's just a correct representation. It's like if you had, like, I don't know if it's a good comparison to make, but if you had, like, the Girl Scouts or something, you might not necessarily, it's like an organization, and it's a specific type of community that they're trying to foster. So I'm not exactly sure which one to take.
Okay. So it's a fine line. You know, even nowadays on TV, you see somebody you know, like in a third world country with a little dirty kid on the lap and says, you know, the message is, you know, here's somebody, here's the kid, and where's the parents, and, you know, this kid's all dirty, he needs really to be taken care of, and the person that needs to provide that care is, you know, the viewers and the contributors. And is that a correct message? Is that what's really going on? Do you understand that, Claire?
Well, I guess I'm confused about what's wrong with them trying to present their case as strongly as possible if they're trying to get money that's, you know, it's going to actually help people. Like, they may be showing the worst examples or whatever. They may be showing the people who've seen the neediest or whatever. But if they if such people exist and they do generally need money, it seems fair.
Okay. Do you think that kid is always dirty and always without their parents?
No, I don't think so, but you wouldn't choose to show someone who's less, I mean, because if you're trying to convince people that they really need, that we really need your help, then you would show them.
Okay. So the dirt is makeup for the commercial?
Oh. I have no idea. Presumably there are actually some kids out there who do have other reasons to support.
Well, can I ask a broader question? And how do you react to people who ask for money on the street, either for themselves or for an unknown charity? Is that a fair question to ask? Go ahead. Sure.
Well, this picture, you know, it is very 50-ish, but in fact, these kids do struggle throughout the day with their orthotics and braces and crutches, and this is a pretty cleaned-up picture. This, to me, represents a picture that makes it all look pretty varnished, almost, as to what their life really is throughout the day.
I looked at the muscular dystrophy and March of Dimes websites, and they have much better pictures of kids smiling and being involved, but, you know,
doing things
with other kids. So, you know, this perception, you know, these methods have changed over the years, but there's still a lot of people with disabilities who really dislike, you know, this kind of promotion, you know, using kids as something to be pitied and taken care of and supported.
I think what it comes down to is that if you're, I mean, I totally get the psychology between, you know, setting up the kids as objects of pity and struggle to raise money and, you know, as she said, there is a tremendous amount of struggle and discomfort and it's really difficult and hard, and empathy, I think, is better than pity, but if you make it too real, then people don't want to deal with it at all.
Mm-hmm.
But then the problem then, you know, fast forward 25 years, now that guy, the kid, is trying to get a job, and society has been inculcated with the message that he's an object of pity and maybe suffering and certainly less than, and he's getting interviewed by somebody who's like, boy, this guy, he could never do this job, he can barely do X, Y, and Z. So that you end up fighting against these stereotypes for the rest of your life. So I think that's what the people that object to Jerry Lewis, you know, there's an organization called Jerry's Kids, which are people with muscular dystrophy fighting Jerry Lewis's stereotyping of, I mean, Jerry Lewis said, if you're in a wheelchair, you're only living half a life. I mean, if you live your life in a wheelchair, that's not real motivating. So so that's the real, I mean, it's like, it's an overarching issue.
Okay. All right.
I've always wondered why it doesn't show like a success story, like this person, because of them, the organization or something, is able to, you know, go to law school or do something positive and use them so that it'll inspire confidence in people to create this attitude that's like, yeah, I could hire somebody like that to run my multi-million-dollar business, as opposed to just an object for me.
Right. Yeah, I haven't watched it for a while, so I don't know what they do other than have people call in with money, with pledges. And by the way, they raised $64 million last year, which is a lot of money. Okay.
They could be made objects of inspiration because of the challenges.
Okay. All right. Okay, thanks. So on Thursday, we will have my colleague Maurice LeBlanc talk about crutches. And he's has been a colleague of mine at the VA, and before that he was at Children's Hospital at Stanford, the Rehab Engineering Center there. Now he's still working with prosthetics, so it ought to be a very interesting talk. But this afternoon we have Jessica Rose. She's an assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at the Stanford School of Medicine and director of the motion and gait analysis lab at the Lucile Packard Children's Hospital. Dr. Rose's research focuses on neuromuscular and musculoskeletal mechanisms underlying gait abnormalities in children with cerebral palsy and other pediatric orthopedic conditions. As the director of the motion and gait analysis lab, her research there has focused on the energy cost of walking, muscle pathology, selective motor control, postural balance, and motor unit firing in CP. And recently she's been investigating the relationship between neonatal microstructural brain development on diffusion tensor MRI and later gait and motor deficits in very low birth weight preterm children. So let's bring up Dr. Jessica Rose.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Let's see. Okay, here we go. That can be okay there.
Do you
have pockets today? There. Okay. So the motion and gait analysis lab at Children's Hospital, at Lucile Packard Children's Hospital at Stanford, is a clinical service where we analyze walking disorders in children and in some adults in order to make surgical and medical treatment plans. And every other week we have what we call pediatric orthopedic gait rounds, and we discuss each patient's data and go over their video and formulate a treatment and surgical plan. And this is done with the physical therapists, the engineers, the bioengineers, mechanical engineers, the orthopedic surgeons and the orthopedic surgery residents, the neurology neurologist or neurology nurse practitioner, and the orthotist. So there's a team of members that meet and discuss this each Wednesday. So we'll... So today, maybe focus on three main teaching points. That would be the phases of the gait cycle, the primary muscle actions during gait, and common gait disorders. So my goal is for you to have an understanding about human walking, and then we'll have plenty of time for questions. And if there's time, we can go over the research. So Stanford actually has a very excellent history of the study of motion, and it started way back in 1878 when Edward Muybridge, a photographer, was called upon to settle a bet by Leland Stanford, and that bet was concerned whether or not all four legs of a horse come off the ground at any point during the horse's gallop. And you can see in, I'll just use that in this frame. that and these two frames. Anyway, indeed, at one point during the gallop, all 4 feet come off the ground. And so this was one of the really first motion studies ever conducted. And it was done with a series of cameras and little very fine wires which were triggered as the horse ran through it. So we have come a long way, but this was really an inspiration in the field of motion analysis. And so we study walking in the gait lab. We also now are starting to study motion of the upper limb and similarly looking at muscle action and during functional activities of the upper limb. But today I'm going to talk about gait. And there are two main phases of the gait cycle, and that's the stance phase when the foot is on the ground and the swing phase. And so a gait cycle is refers to it, the movement of a single limb. And there's three main tasks. When you first put your weight on the ground, it's called initial contact. And there's a period of weight acceptance that occurs. There's a little loading response. You might not notice this, but your knee flexes every step you take, just a little bit as you take that first part of the step. And I've never been able to perceive it myself, but it always comes up on the kinematics, the motion studies. So it's really there. Then there's the single limb support during mid-stance and terminal stance, and then finally during the swing phase, the task is to advance the limb forward. And during a single gait cycle, muscle activity has a very set pattern. And for the most part, you can see from this illustration where the active muscles are shown in red, that the muscles that cross the hip and the knee are active at this initial contact. And that's in contrast to the calf muscle, which is active in the middle of the of stance phase down here. And so, in general, if you sort of tune into, two areas of muscle action, it's the muscles that stabilize the hip and the knee that are active right before and right after initial contact, getting ready to accept weight onto that limb. And then the calf muscle is active right in the middle of the stance phase, and that serves a very essential purpose in gait, which we'll talk about in a minute. So here's initial contact, and normally it is with the heel first contact. In the case of a condition such as cerebral palsy or stroke, if incomplete spinal cord injury, you'll have what's called toe forefoot contact rather than a heel contact. And that's probably the most common gait deficit in neuromuscular conditions. And then in mid-stance, after initial contact, you have the action of the calf muscle, which is to control the tibia, which is the lower leg bone, advancement over the foot. And that's very essential to keeping the body upright. And this is an illustration of what is happening there. There are three foot and ankle rockers that are discussed in gait, and they are first the heel rocker, where the fulcrum is right around the heel, rotating around the heel. It's very transient, momentary. The second rocker is when the tibia, the lower leg bone, is rotating around the axis of the ankle. And this is where the calf muscle is so essential. It's essentially fixing the ankle position in neutral, or getting ready to fix it in neutral, and restraining the tibial advancement. And if it's weak or if it's over lengthened, unfortunately, that used to occur more often in surgery, it's to very devastating consequences, so that you get a crouched gait. So that action of the calf muscle is very essential to fix this ankle. And then finally, the third rocker is the forefoot rocker here. The ankle is fixed, and it allows the heel to come off the ground, and the fulcrum is now around the forefoot, and this is what, you know, allows the body to move forward and to maintain the forward momentum of the gait. So that's very, very essential actions of muscles right there in mid-stance. In terminal stance, you have, you know, as I've just mentioned, the locked ankle and this heel rise, which is very essential to moving the body forward and maintaining the forward momentum. Now, in the case of cerebral palsy, if you have weakness or perhaps an over-lengthened calf muscle, look what happens. You get this crouched gait. So no longer is the calf muscle restraining the tibia over the foot, and it collapses forward and causes a very energy-costly gait. In the swing phase, the essential sort of features of swing is that you achieve a peak knee flexion early in the swing phase, about 60 degrees of knee flexion, and that you are able to dorsiflex your ankle to a neutral position in order to clear the foot with each swing phase. So we look for these types of events during the gait cycle when we analyze somebody's walking. And we, you know, our job is to not only identify what's wrong with the gait, but also why and what's the cause and the etiology of the gait in order to make an effective treatment plan. And we do this through a number of different tests, which include video analysis, kinematics and kinetics, and dynamic EMG, postural balance, and energy cost while walking. And I'll explain those terms in just a minute, but in addition to this, recently we're now able to implement musculoskeletal models based on the kinematics that we measure. And we're now, for example, whether or not we recommend a hamstring lengthening in a child with cerebral palsy depends on what they look like in this hamstring length model, which is shown down below here. So a child is seen in the gait lab. They have markers, which are shown here. Real time, you see this come up on the computer while the child's walking. And based on the markers, the joint centers are found by the computer. And we can then get the motion and also create models, which will tell us, in this case, the length of the hamstring during the gait cycle, which is really essential because in a case of crouched gait that you just saw a picture of, there are a number of different reasons. And, you know, up until recently, the same surgery was performed for everyone who's walking with a crouched gait, but in about a third of them, they weren't getting better. And so we are, you know, the field is learning and the orthopedic surgery is learning to be more precise about what causes. If you think about walking in a crouched gait where your knees are bent, it can actually be caused because of hip flexion tightness. It can be caused because of knee flexion tightness. And it can be caused by what we just looked at with the calf muscle weakness, failure to keep the tibia up, you know, restrain it from rotating over the foot. And so those are three potential causes of a crouched gait, which is illustrated in the skeleton below. And this is a graph of hamstring length during the gait cycle relative to what you would, you know, expect it to be. And so this is something that we use now to determine whether or not somebody receives a hamstring lengthening surgery, and the outcome is improved, which is what we need. More people going into this field and creating good models that can make a big difference in the lives of people with neuromuscular conditions and much improve our treatment. So here is a video of a child walking. Okay, does anyone want to say what you notice is different than the normal walk that you're used to seeing? Yes, good. He's toe walking. Yes, he's up on his toes. Good. Yep, good. Yep. Internally rotated. And so internally rotated foot progression, that's either coming from the hips or sometimes the knee. In this case, you can see by the crosses that it's coming from the hip. Sometimes that you can see somebody walking, you know, with this internal rotated foot progression. But those, the crosses on the knees are actually, you know, straight ahead. And so that's actually the rotating of the tibia that is responsible. And you'd want to know that because some of the surgery that's done are called osteotomies, and they actually take a wedge and rotate the bone, and you want to get the right bone.
I'm just wondering, mostly
when you walk your arm swing, is it hard to spell? Yes, very good. No reciprocal arm swing. Or minimal reciprocal arm swing. Yeah, good. Absolutely. And the knees are flexed. And there's more lateral shift side to side than you would want. Okay. Okay, and here's one more. So that last gait cycle is sort of most, I think, revealing. So, yeah, good. Circumduction. And why might she do that? Why might she circumduct that left foot, that left hip? Exactly, right. She's not clearing her foot. And, you know, I would say compared to the last video that weakness is probably more of a problem with her than the last child, but it can be both a combination of tightness around the, you know, the back of the ankle, which tends to get those muscles get tight, and weakness in the front.
Just curious, she looked like she was assuming that's a horse plate before.
Right. Yes.
Do they have any video of her trying to walk without trying to hit the horse plate?
Well, she's not trying. Let's see. Does she have marker? Oh yeah, yeah. She's trying. Oh, did it? Yeah. Let's take a look. Yeah. Yeah. Right. She's trying to give us good data there. We're seeing her. Right? We're seeing her best efforts. Yeah. It's. Right. We. We have to take all of that into consideration. Good point. So we're looking at kinematics, which is the joint motion, and kinetics, which are the forces that cross the joint, that pass through the joint. And we look at the kinematics using what we have is our 8 digital motion cameras that are mounted on the wall, and they mark the position of light reflective markers, and then because the space is calibrated, we can find the joint centers and we get the motion in that respect. So we're really thrilled to have our 8 digital motion capture cameras, and I have to contrast this with Industrial Light and Magic up in the Presidio, which has 40 cameras and 60 PhDs, but a very fun tour. So kinetics, which are the forces that cross the joint, are very important because they affect how the bones develop and affect things, you know, like arthritis and very important to record, and they are recorded by getting the data as the foot, a single foot, you know, walks over that force plate. And the kinetic data is obtained using the kinematic data, the joint motion, and then the floor reaction force that's recorded in that force plate. This is kinematic data, typical kinematic data in the sagittal plane, which is the side view. And so you can see the normal motion of a single gait cycle. This is the hip flexion and extension from the side view. And normally in your, you know, at the beginning of your step at initial contact, that hip is flexed about 40 degrees. And, I guess it's green up on the screen, okay? As you come through stance, your hip is extending, and it, you know, it fully extends at what's called a trailing thigh at the end of stance phase. And then it flexes, reaching a peak knee, we're at the hip. It flexes in swing again. And this was actually the little boy that you saw in the video. And so he's actually, his hip flexion was somewhat reduced. Not markedly reduced, but what we did see is his knee. So here's the hip, the knee, the ankle, and the foot, and a single gait cycle. And here is the normal excursion and motion of the knee. And I had mentioned at initial contact, the knee is straight when you first come and put your heel on the ground. But you have this loading response, and you can see that here of where the knee flexes, you know, a certain number of degrees. And when you walk out, notice that. See whether or not you can pick up that little bit of flexion, because it's pretty universal, but not something that's too easy to detect. The knee then extends fully in mid-stance and then flexes to a peak knee flexion in early swing phase, and then rapidly extends and gets ready to take weight on for the next step. So this child comes in flexed at initial contact, about 30 degrees, and then stays flexed throughout the gait cycle here. And this is a very energy costly gait. So anytime you have to use your quadriceps to hold yourself up against gravity, it's going to cost you more energy than normal for walking. And he is not achieving peak knee flexion. So this is what would be called a stiff knee gait. Even though he's in the flexed position, because the excursion of the knee is limited. Ankle dorsiflexion, plantar flexion, you know, wasn't too bad in his case. So he's up on his toes, but actually the angle of the ankle was not terribly plantar flexed. He is not reaching full dorsiflexion in swing, but enough to clear the foot. And then, of course, the foot progression angle was internally rotated, which you spotted. So kinetics, I mentioned you use a combination of the kinematics, the joint motion, and the floor reaction force, which is recorded on the force plate. I think when that video was taken, we had one force plate. Now we have two force plates embedded in the ground. And this is the floor reaction force. And so it's that force in combination with the motion that we get the kinetic data. And the kinetic data, the forces and moments that cross the joint, you know, is very essential for normal gait and for maintaining, you know, momentum throughout the gait. And just walking on your toes like that creates an abnormal joint plantar flexion moment. So here's the normal plantar flexion moment, and it increases and develops nicely over throughout the stance phase. And this is the highest joint moment throughout the gait cycle at any joint, is the ankle plantar flexion moment at the end of stance. So it's essential, and it's what we saw was missing in that child who was crouched down and had the weak calf. And so it's very, very essential to moving the body forward. And if you just walk up on your toes, you will get what's called a sort of a double bump, or an early plantar flexion moment. And it's no longer pushing you forward. It's almost decelerating you. So that's, you know, that poses problems. It's the main problem with walking on your toes. It does reduce, of course, that four-foot rocker that we talked about, the third rocker, and has a negative effect on your forward momentum. So that's kinetics, the forces that cross the joint. We also look at dynamic EMG, which is the timing of muscles during the gait cycle. And we do that with foot switches, pressure-sensitive foot switches or markers. And we use electrodes to measure the EMG activity of the muscles. And those are both surface electrodes as well as fine wire. We have to access muscles that are deeper with fine wire electrodes, and those are about the diameter of a hair, so they're very, you know, thin, but kids do not like those, and so we try to keep them at a minimum. And some gait labs use a lot of them. Shriners Hospital uses often 8 fine wire electrodes, 8 different muscles, and it's just, it's kind of interesting. That would seem like it would be really not tolerated in at our hospital, and so it's kind of interesting, the psychology. Shriners Hospital is, you know, it's all paid for, and it could be, that mentality of the parents and the children is, you know, allows that. I always think it's interesting. I just know we could never get away with it, and it's one of those aspects. It's an area that, you know, it would be great if nobody ever needed to use fine wire electrodes. It's an area that you know, would be very improved with further research.
What are the advantages of fine wire electrodes over the other?
The main advantage is you don't get you know, noise from other muscles, and that's it's very difficult to access some muscles because of their depth relative to other muscles. Also, for research purposes, to record things like motor unit activity, you know, we used to think the only way to do it was with fine wire electrodes, but now, actually, we have someone coming over from Turin, Italy, who they've developed a surface electrode that looks really promising, so it's definitely room for improvement. So this is, we saw this picture of the muscles that are active during the gait cycle, and here they are in black and white. And what you can see down here are the muscles that cross the ankle. And you can see how they're active, you know, in stance phase. This, again, is a single gait cycle, 0 to 100% of the gait cycle. This is stance, and then the last 40% is swing phase. And then you can see, you know, a lot of these muscles that cross the hip and knee are active around initial contact, before and after. And here's a sort of somewhat of an exception. The rectus femoris is one of the 4 quads. The other quads only cross the knee and they extend the knee, but the rectus femoris crosses both the hip and the knee. And so it's both a hip flexor and a knee extensor. And so it is on with the other quads around initial contact. It's also on in the transition between stance and swing to help the hip flex into swing. And this is what, in a clinical report, the EMG ends up looking like. And so, again, it's a single gait cycle, and it's interpreted in terms of the motion of the cycle. And just what I want you to note here is this single gait cycle is 0 to 100% of the gait cycle. This is stance. This is swing. And the normal timing of the muscle, here's rectus femoris, is indicated here in black below. It should be on around initial contact and in the transition between stance and swing. But in this case, it's on, you know, throughout the gait cycle. And vastus lateralis, also, you know, a major quad, is what we would call prolonged. So it's prolonged throughout stance. Now, is this a primary problem? Should this be, you know, lengthened? No, because you see the child is walking in a crouched gait. They are flexed, and there's, you know, a great need, therefore, to keep the quadriceps on throughout stance in order to prevent them from falling down and collapsing. And so this is really what we would call a compensatory EMG timing. So in contrast to that, here's the gastrocnemius, and it's pre-firing, and it's on, so it's on before it should be on. Again, it should only be on during stance phase, and this, the gastrocnemius is the calf muscle, and it's on continuously. So this would be considered a primary problem. You can see the foot pressure sensors here in red and blue and green and pink. And what do you notice about the foot pressure recordings here with the gait cycle? Is there a color missing? Yeah. So what? Right. So what's going on?
Walking on tippy toes.
Yeah. No heel contact at all, and you can see the normal timing with the toe is actually not happening as well. So that this is very helpful. We were talking about sonification earlier, and that's the audio representation of data. I know there's a better definition of it, but that's how I think of it. Be very, very instructive to people in gait analysis, looking at video and data, to be able to hear steps and to hear the cadence of steps and to hear the symmetry of steps. There's a lot that you can pick up just sound-wise. I've always wished we had that in our gait rounds, that we could actually hear the person walking. And I guess one thing that's kind of interesting about sonification is this is the only sonification a gait study that I know is people can distinguish between male and female gait very readily by just hearing it, like 95% of the time. So it's kind of interesting. So that's EMG. That's the timing, and you can also see the amplitude of the EMG. The high level here is the, 100% of maximal voluntary contraction, and so you can see the gastrocnemius is working very hard. In reality, the gastrocnemius is so big, it's very hard to get a true maximal voluntary contraction on the exam table. So I think that may account for some of this amplitude. The way you test for strength of the calf muscle is to have somebody go up and down on their toes 20 times. So that's hard. It's a challenging thing to do, but that would be considered the normal muscle strength. Okay, so postural balance is, essential to normal gait, and we test for it in part because surgical outcome is very unpredictable if you have poor balance. And so we want to know what patients are good candidates for surgery versus being unpredictable. And so we look at the center of pressure between the 2 feet. They are standing on a force plate, which is on top of a floor. And you can see the normal path length of the center pressure between the 2 feet is very small and very contained here, and that would be the normal sway path. And that's in contrast to somebody who would have balance deficits. For example, if they had cerebellar injury in the vermis of the cerebellum, in the center part of the cerebellum, which processes balance. You'd probably see this with someone with an inner ear infection. There's a number of different, stops along the way to producing normal balance that can cause balance problems. In cerebral palsy, it would be normally due to an injury in the cerebellum or another area of the brain that's used for balance processing. But also think about the child that's on their tippy toes, on very high up on their tippy toes, and that's such a small surface area. So right there, that's going to affect your balance, and so you always have to keep that in mind. I've seen kids with a very crouched gait, but they are dorsiflexed, and that's very energy costly. But the upside, most of these kids can stand perfectly still. They have perfect balance. And so, they're actually maybe better processing balance than a lot of us. And so we look at postural sway with the eyes open and closed, because if you close the eyes and you see the sway increase, it's a sign that you're more dependent on visual input to maintain your balance, which if you close your eyes and you try to hold your balance, you'll see there's a tremendous amount of input that you get visually. Similarly, one study that we looked at in recovering alcoholics showed the importance of light touch to maintaining balance. And so we had a cane that would collapse if you put any kind of weight on it. It allowed you to touch it lightly, but you're not able to put any weight on it. And so basically we found that their postural balance correlated very highly with the volume of the cerebellar vermis, which had shrunk in the process of becoming an alcoholic. And the good news actually is, you know, years after stopping drinking, the vermis actually improved and increased in its size, which is great. But what was very dramatic is how much touching the cane helped to improve balance in this population. And so to the point that their balance became normal. So this, a little bit of light touch gives a whole lot of sensory information to your neuropathways, which process postural balance. And it's not till we are, our sensory input is taken away that we appreciate how much it helps us move. And another sort of visual of this, or maybe not visual, but perceptual thought about how much we depend on proprioception, the sense of where we are in space, and just general sensation of a limb. People with spinal cord injury who have lost sensory input, you know, we try to, achieve some walking with artificial stimulation. And to sort of get a sense of what this would be like, think about going to the dentist. And think about the Novocaine injection. And think about your jaw and how it feels after you come back from the dentist and you try to chew. It's weird and it's awkward and you really don't know where you are. And so this is the case, with somebody with a complete spinal cord injury where they don't have that sensation. So you have to consider this sensory system. I just give that example because it's really important to be aware of how much sensation affects our ability to move. And finally, energy expenditure during gait is very important. It's sort of the ultimate functional measure, an outcome measure. And this shows what we call the energy expenditure index, which is based on heart rate. We also look at this with oxygen uptake, and you get the similar U-shaped curve in relation to walking speed. So at slow walking speed, so this is an energy efficiency measure. So you're looking at walking heart rate, but it also could be walking oxygen uptake, and essentially over the walking speed. So this is a lot like fuel mileage. You're looking in the car at miles per gallon, and in this case, you're looking at gallons per mile. You're looking at gallons of blood being pumped or oxygen being consumed per distance walked. And so it's a measure of efficiency, and the lower the value, the better. And so what we find are at these slow walking speeds, you get high energy cost and poor efficiency, whereas at people's most comfortable walking speeds, they have sort of an optimal level of energy cost, and so we like to see this kind of information. And in this case, this was hamstring surgery, and it really was had a good outcome, and the child was able to walk much straighter, use their quadriceps much less, and reduce the amount of energy that they used during walking. And we test at a comfortable and a fast walking speed in order to get a spectrum. So that's energy cost assessment. And it's one functional measure. Pedometers might be another, way to get a functional measure. Very important to, that we understand how somebody's, actually able to avoid fatigue and engage in their daily activities. So, let's see. I wanted to talk about gait deficits a little bit, and you'll let me know when I need to. How much time do we have? Okay, great.
But, leave some time for questions.
Okay, all right. So in neuromuscular conditions, there's a number of different gait deficits that have different terms, and I just quickly, so that you're familiar with these terms because you may hear them, equinus gait is toe walking. It's just a term that I don't know where it came from, but it's like a horse, and I guess because on the hoofs, that's maybe... reminded somebody of toe walking at some point, but it's stuck, and it's called equinus gait. That, in combination with an inverted ankle, is called equinovarus gait. So that would be distinct and different muscles that you would be doing surgery on if you saw equinovarus gait or an inverted gait versus just a plantar flexed toe walking gait. There's a gait called pseudoequinus, where the knees are bent, they're up on their toes, but the ankles are actually in neutral, and you've got to be very careful to note that because you don't want to lengthen ankle plantar flexors if they can get their ankle to neutral. And just looking at somebody walking on their toes, it will often look like they're plantar flexed, but they're not, so we call it pseudoequinus. That's in contrast to jump gait, where they actually are plantar flexed. So their knees are bent, they're in a crouched gait, but their ankles are plantar flexed. So they look like they're, you know, jumping out of the starting blocks of a race. And I guess that's where that name came from. And then there's the crouched gait, which we talked a lot about when you have the knees are bent, but the ankles are dorsiflexed, and very costly energy. Energetics to that type of crouched gait. And then finally, the stiff knee gait, which you saw the kinematic graph of when the excursion of the knee is limited and it stays, you know, in a narrow range of motion. In this case, it's flexed. It can be a stiff knee extended gait, and you don't get much knee flexion at all. So those are the pathologic gait primary gait deficits in people who have neuromuscular conditions. And in the case of musculoskeletal conditions, such as, they're sometimes also involve neuro aspects, but involve primarily weakness, polio, dislocation, arthritis, muscular dystrophy. The causes of the gait deficits may be pain, weakness, structural abnormalities, and then loss of motion, and any number of the combinations above. So a painful gait is also called an antalgic gait, and it's really any painful gait that reduces the loading and decreases the time of the stance phase on the affected side. And again, you can imagine how sonification might come in handy here. You'd be hearing the timing of the gait. You'd hear that one of the stance phases were shorter, and you might just pick it up like that, which would be nice. If you have a stone in your shoe, then you know what an antalgic gait is like. You don't put your weight down for long. Coxalgic gait is just a painful hip gait where you will have strong hip abductors and structural stability, but because of pain in the hip, you will shift over to that affected side and decompress, take the pressure off your hip. And I'll show you a diagram of that in just a minute real quick. So here is a diagram of why people lurch over during gait. And if you see somebody sort of lurching over to a side, you will know that that's the affected side. People lurch over, they lean over to the affected side in the case of weak abductors or painful hips. And so there's a reason for this biomechanically, and that reason is that the fulcrum of the hip joint, which produces the joint reaction forces around the hip, you know, are centered in in the hip. And a result of the lever arm, the length between the center of mass of the body and that fulcrum in the hip versus the lever arm of the abductor muscles and the fulcrum of that sort of think of it as a teeter-totter. And so if you lean over to your affected side, you're essentially shifting over your center of mass closer to the fulcrum, decreasing that lever arm and decreasing the demand on the hip abductors because they have to counter that in order to keep the pelvis straight, level, and or it will be, you know, decreasing compression. And if arthritis is the problem, then it, you know, you definitely want to be reducing compression around the hip. So that's sort of a simple explanation of the hip biomechanics and why people lean over to the affected side in order to reduce the pressure on the hip and the demand on hip abductors. So if you have weak abductors, you will lean over to, this was sort of a, I guess we talked about antalgic gait. Here's our weak abductors. If you have weak abductors on, say, the left side, the pelvis on the other side is going to drop because the action of these hip abductors is to keep the pelvis level. Very, very important action. So if they're weak, the other, you know, the opposite side of the pelvis drops. And one way to make it easier to hold the pelvis up and to reduce the load on the abductors is to lean over and reduce that lever arm that we just saw. So that's called a Trendelenburg gait, and it's very common. You see somebody walking. But the Trendelenburg gait refers to somebody with weak abductors. And that's here. You can see the difference between Trendelenburg and that painful hip gait, the coxalgic gait, where the difference is they both lean over to the affected side. But in the Trendelenburg, where the hip abductors are weak, here the opposite pelvis side of the pelvis drops. And so you see that. And that does not happen with the painful hip gait. The hip abductors are strong, and they can still hold the pelvis level. Few final examples of weakness and how they affect gait. The gluteus maximus lurch. If you have weak hip extensors, the tendency will be to stay in hip extension to avoid having to use the hip extensors to keep you upright. And this concept of avoidance continues with the quadriceps avoidance gait. And I don't have a picture of it, but basically if your quadriceps are weak or you have an impaired, anterior cruciate ligament, you will want to reduce the load on the quads. In the case of polio, spinal cord injury, you may just hold your knee stiff the entire time straight and avoid ever having to have the quads hold you up against gravity when your knee is at all bent. In the case of an ACL, you know, insufficiency, it's minimal, and you notice it just at small parts of the gait cycle. But that concept of avoiding positions which require that muscle to work is consistent. And finally, a drop foot, very common gait deficit in stroke patients. And, you know, we saw, I think that was a drop foot that we saw in the second video where the ankle dorsiflexors were not strong enough to hold the foot up and to clear the foot. And so that's would be maybe the fourth type of gait deficit that results from muscle weakness. The Trendelenburg with the weak hip abductors, the gluteus maximus lurch with the weak gluteus maximus, the quad avoidance gait, and then the drop foot. And so finally, just want to remind you or bring up for the first time, use the cane on the able side, okay? There's a very good reason for that. And somebody had brought up reciprocal arm swing, how very important that is. Reciprocal arm swing really allows the person to walk smoothly. That little bit of trunk rotation is very important. If you use the gait you use the cane on your able side, then you can take advantage of using reciprocal arm swing. If you use it on the side that's affected, you have to go along with that affected side, and it, it prevents you from having reciprocal arm swing. Also, putting it on the able side widens your base of support, which is very important for balance, and it will reduce the demand on the affected side. It provides essentially a longer lever arm of the, you know, forces acting on that side of the fulcrum. So there's lots of really good reasons to use a cane on the able side. And with that, I'll ask if you have any questions.
I can see that the walking is a very mechanical system. You get bones, muscles, and you know that has representations as mechanical systems. So my question is, what opportunities are there for mechanical engineers and other engineers to help you with some of the problems that, that you see besides the sonification that, that you mentioned already?
Well, there's actually a number of them. One of the things that is sort of desperately needed in the field is to be able to keep that tibia up. Once the muscle is too weak or over-lengthened or for whatever reason, you know, you lose the ability. It's fairly common. It's very devastating to the gait and increases the energy cost tremendously. But we have at this point no ankle, foot, orthoses that really sufficiently holds that tibia up. So we can hold the foot up pretty well with an AFO. In other words, for drop foot, we can, you know, we have a number of orthotics that are light and are sufficiently able to hold the foot up, but none so far that keep the tibia from falling forward too much. So I don't know what it will take, but it'll take a very lightweight metal and, you know, a very good design that, you know, kids are happy to use, and just really would make a big difference. We cannot shorten muscles. So once that happens, once they get too weak, once they get too long, that's it. And so that's one.
If you're going to do surgery on a child, is there a certain age range
where
it's better or worse?
Yes. Kind of like 6 to 12 is maybe ideal, and a lot of children will have it multiple times during that. And I would just say this, that, you know, in my view, the bony surgery is most effective, and that the muscle, you know, surgery may be temporarily effective, but we don't get great, you know, long-term results from it. And so we're finding things like, you know, very high-intense exercise training is actually better for, you know, or when possible. Treatment, it does make you stronger, and it can improve gait. We're looking at, just starting to look at the effects of artificial walking for kids with cerebral palsy. It's been used for spinal cord injury, and it has a long way to go before the gait is, you know, very functional, but there's a lot we can do, and that would be another example, very much so needing measures of basically accelerometry or measures of sway during the gait to feed back to these systems that of electrical stimulation, because you know, you'd want to know before you fall, and we overstimulate all muscles in artificial walking to prevent falling, and it's so fatiguing people can only really walk down the hall. And so how to reduce that amount of fatigue and that amount of artificial stimulation would be to know much more sensitively what's going on with the gait, and only, you know, use those muscles when you had to use them. That's another. There's one other one. Oh yeah, what? Just on. So on gait training, also, I guess this is kind of sonification. It can be sonification, but there's, you know, a lot that people can do to train themselves if they're given the feedback that they need to know what they're not doing. And so that's just an area of biofeedback. And it can be sonification, it can be vibration, it can be any number of sensory input that people can respond quickly to and improve their body mechanics during gait.
Thank you.
Well, long term, they should not. Yeah, I mean, the whole idea is to restore that lever arm and yeah, we don't, the patients that we see don't have a lot of total knee joint replacements, but I know a number of people with them, I think you're, you know, ideally, no, but whether that is, in fact, just theoretical and not clinically true, it would be very interesting to find out. I think there may be a little. I'm not aware of it. It's a really, really good question, and it could take gait analysis out of the lab, which would be fantastic. There'd be a number of uses for, you know, an insole that would really, you know, in detail pick up foot pressures and ideally free moment the torque. I mean, that sports-wise could be a fantastic training device, actually. But I'm not here to talk about golf. No. But I do.
The clinical side as well.
Yeah.
In terms of the feedback mechanism where someone's walking.
Oh, yeah.
The impact with the lower limb versus maybe the hip region. Because what's interesting is from the early gaits of the child, the knee flexion extension was really off, yet the hip flexion extension was
right.
Almost within a normal range,
mm-hmm.
whereas the other parts of the lower leg system
will
not. Right.
There's some, that's where it's curious.
Oh, it's feedback. There's compensatory aspect.
Right. I would say that there's very minimal research on devices that can be used as biofeedback right now. They're out there, but they're sort of far and few between. They have used strain gauge and some accelerometry, but the field is wide open and in, you know, very bad need of good research on improving gait patterns that way.
Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, beginning
to show
a graph of a girl with 2K.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I would think that would be preferable because of balance issues. I find that just using one cane distorts my
Yeah. Well, you know, they're finding the hikers that use those very lightweight, that definitely, you know, is helping all, you know, a broad spectrum of people walk with more, you know, stability, probably in part due to that light touch sense. So I think that that's probably the case. I'm trying to think. Kids with cerebral palsy generally don't, you know, they want to use as little equipment as possible, but as maybe we get older and wiser and, you know, more aware of body mechanics, then I think what's important changes to a certain degree. But I think with kids, basically, they just want the less.
They don't want to draw more attention.
Exactly, right, yeah.
Early in the 80s, there was a big push and a lot of interest in functional electric stimulation, you know, Dr. Petrosky and Dr. Barsley at the VA.
Yes.
I've seen all those, yes. Some of the subjects that he worked on, and things sort of seem to die down for a while. You know, what's the state of the art of that, and what kind of opportunities are there, what kind mm-hmm. of advances do you see in that area?
Oh, I think it's a really important area, and it's in bad need of more scientists going into it. And, you know, the main limitations at this point for spinal cord injury are overstimulation of muscles. And so how do you reduce that, you know, that that overstimulation and to get it to where you're just stimulating what they need and nothing more than that, but also providing safety. And so, you know, that would be more better feedback control systems of, you know, the trajectory of the body and the balance. And and then, you know, possibly combining it with very effective lightweight bracing, and that brings you back to this, you know, brace that we need of super light metal that can help hold people up, because people do actually very well walking with a fused ankle. You'd be surprised. So, I mean, just taking care of that aspect and bracing the ankle, but that hasn't really been looked at as much as it needs to be looked at in terms of artificial FES walking. And what's interesting, because it's so fatiguing, and I think people are, you know, that it hasn't really received enough attention scientifically, although they've made great headways in delivering the signal. So that part is you know, progressing well. And they there's a fine electrode out there now from that same Case Western Center that Marcellet founded. And it potentially will be able to activate muscles from the level of the femoral nerve. And they've discovered the femoral nerve is not round. It is like, you know, like that. And so you can actually delineate different muscles, which is very cool. It would make it much less invasive. So right now you know, basically implant the electrode in the muscle, you run the wires underneath the skin up to the hip, and that's where the transmitter is. And it's surprising these electrodes are in for 2 years, and that's great, but think how much simpler that would be if you could actually activate the muscles from the level of the hip. And so that, you know, it's really ripe for getting the system to biomechanically work better. And I do have a number of ideas on this subject. And it's now being applied to children with cerebral palsy, and it looked in the first study as effective as surgery, which is great because you're not weakening the muscle with electrical stimulation. And the thought now that they see by activating these muscles peripherally, they're actually thinking that they see more voluntary movement. They take the electrodes out and they're seeing more voluntary movement than they had previously. And the idea is that they, you know, if there's an explanation, if this is real, it's that by activating those pathways and maintaining the neural system better, they're directing the sprouting that does happen in the spinal cord but really went nowhere before to these active pathways. And so there is theoretical reason to believe that this may be happening, and we'll see whether it pans out. But that's a really important area that has probably more potential than any other area to dramatically affect people's ability to move.
Any other questions?
Well, now I'd like to thank Jessica for her excellent talk. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to talk to the people in the project. Thank you all.
Mm-hmm. Hi. I wonder if I can talk with you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to start, but I feel that maybe you can help.
Yeah, definitely. I can give you my card and you can email me. Or.
Do you mind if I have talked with you about my situation?
Mm-hmm.
And I think whatever you have can help me. Do you have time?
Right now I just have a few minutes, but I can give you my card and you could make a time to meet.
Yes. So 5 years ago, I fell in the shower. And then I didn't take good care of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 years later, before that, I had a slightly tumor. And then I got it removed here in Brooklyn. And then,
where is the tumor?
Right here.
Oh, uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
But then the tumor is at the back of the knee.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, I just prepare for more and more after classes, and I have been doing CPR and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I try
Here, what I'm going to do is give you my card, and see, it's in here somewhere, and you can email me, and you know, you can always be seen in the Gate Lab for, you know, to get an analysis. Maybe you didn't have this email, so that will work.